podcasts. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome to The Profile on Premier Christian Radio with me, Megan Cornwell. This is the show where we delve into a person's life, faith, and ministry. Today, I'm speaking with Lisa Fields. Lisa is the founder of the Jew3 Project, an apologetics organization doing some really important work to help Christians communicate and defend their faith. Lisa is herself an in-demand apologist whose areas of expertise include race, incarnational apologetics, and engaging the next generation. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I thank God for technology. We're not in the same country, but we can still have a conversation because of platforms like Zoom. So I'm excited to be here.
So Lisa, just for context, you're actually in Jacksonville, Florida, aren't you, at the moment, which
yes.
is amazing. And at the time of recording this, we're both still in some measure of lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a bit about how life's changed for you since the pandemic started.
So life has been different. I was traveling all the time before this. And so definitely now just home, stationary. In addition to that, a lot of Zoom meetings, a lot of conference calls. And it's funny because sometimes you think, okay, I'm off the road, I won't be working as much. But I feel like with this new reality, many of my friends and I have said, we feel like we're working more than we were before. I don't know if you feel that same way. Because there's meetings on top of meetings on top of meetings to try to keep people connected, but you end up doing more work and you daily focus on your work because you're in Zoom meetings. So
so what does your work look like on a day-to-day basis? What sort of things are you doing?
It could look like recording podcasts. It could look like editing. It could look like brainstorming meetings. It varies from day to day.
So in terms of America at the moment, Lisa, I mean, we've been kind of watching and on the news about the number of deaths and Trump's response. How has the church been responding to the pandemic?
Yeah, I think it depends on the different sects of churches. So I think, especially in African-American space, which I'm probably more familiar with than any other space, I would say there's a lot of aid going on. African-American churches, many are becoming testing sites to help with people on the margins who are not able to get testing. So they're really trying to be the hands and feet in this time, pivoting from from in-person services to online services, which can be a challenge if the congregation is elderly. So I think everybody's kind of trying to pivot and trying to find ways in which to protect people. And I think really in our African-American context, it's even more challenging because we're the ones who are disproportionately affected by it. I think African-American pastors are trying to be careful in how they engage their parishioners so they won't put them even further at risk, but they'll also be an aid and a help. So you have churches like in Chicago, like my friend Watson Jones and Charlie Bates, who have created with other churches this coalition to help fund where those people on the margins who can't get food, they make sure they provide food for them mm-hmm. during this time. So I think different churches are responding in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Another big event going on, of course, at the moment is the Black Lives Matter demonstrations. And we've been watching that on the news here, and we've had our own demonstrations in cities across the UK. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense, Lisa, why this particular tragedy has led to such an impassioned response to racism around the world?
I think particularly with the George Floyd, when you see someone put their knee on someone's neck for almost 9 minutes on video, it's no dispute to many that this is an injustice. You know, I think this is one of the times where people are saying, like, they're forced to reckon with the injustice in our police system. And the visual, I think, provided, like, we've seen people get shot, but getting shot is kind of an immediate thing in most cases. If you shoot a person multiple times, and you can kind of desensitized to it. But that kind of suffocation on camera, I think, really created a reaction in people's hearts, and like was like, this is enough is enough.
We'll get on later to talk a bit more about some of the issues affecting people of colour. But for now, let's turn to your story, Lisa. On the profile, we'd like to find out how our guests grew up, where they grew up, and how they became Christians. Can you share a little bit about your journey to faith?
Yeah, so I'm a PK, a pastor's kid. I've been in church my whole life. I was born on a Sunday, and my father was a minister of music. He was over the music department at a larger church in Jacksonville, Florida. And so he was on the organ playing when he found out that my mom was going into labor. So he rushed to the hospital, was able to see me be born, saw me after I was born, and then went back to church and continued to play. Finished his responsibilities and then came back. A little bit about how, like, my family is immersed in church culture, and that's been my life for most of my life. Got saved during my teenage years, and I always say if you grew up in church, you get saved multiple times. because at every youth revival, they're like, rededicate your life. So you have, like, a whole bunch of rededications and you don't quite know which one took all the way. But I think my faith really became my own when in college. I never quite questioned why I believe what I believe. I was immersed in church culture. I was in a Christian bubble. My parents taught me the Bible. My friends came from a similar background. So it was like never, oh, this isn't true. It's kind of like, of course it's true. I didn't have any reason to question it until I got to college. And I took a New Testament course really just to sharpen my faith and thinking this would be like Sunday school, but it was just a regular secular university. It wasn't a Bible college. So I didn't realize that New Testament at a secular university was different than Sunday school learning New Testament. And so I had no frame of reference for that. And so the first day of class, my professor said, I'm going to change everything you thought you knew about Jesus. And at that very moment, I was like, I don't think this is going to be like Sunday school. And she really challenged me. And I really went into like this crisis of faith. Like, do I really believe the Bible? Like, can I trust it? It was so many different authors. Like, we used the textbook from Bart Ehrman. And so Bart Ehrman is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and he tries to discredit the authority of scripture. And so he always talks about the dating, and he pushes the dating further out. And like, I'm starting to question because I had never thought about these things at all. So it all came like at me at one time. And so my dad, through that experience, was like, well, you should check out this apologist named Ravi Zacharias. And so I started listening to Ravi, fell in love with his work, and it really helped me navigate the questions that I was dealing with. As I got into apologetics, I was like, well, outside of Ravi, I don't see really many people of color. I didn't see any African Americans. So I wanted to do something to bridge the gap for African Americans in apologetics, because I think a lot of just majority culture apologetics was missing the questions that African Americans were having.
And what kind of questions do you think that those are coming from the African-American community? How are they different from the questions that are being asked by other groups?
Mm-hmm. So classical apologetics spends a lot of time on proving the existence of God. And in the Black community, atheism isn't usually something that's thriving. It's on the rise, but it's still a slow rise in our communities. So most Black people believe God exists. It's where is he in suffering? And then in light of the cultural impact that racism has had and how the Bible was misused in slavery, like where was God during that time? Mm-hmm. Is Christianity a white man's religion? And so those all came from the manipulation of scripture during the transatlantic slave trade, slavery, antebellum slavery, and all of those things.
And I guess I've heard people say that because there are so few, well, maybe not in the in America, but certainly in the UK, there are so few Black theologians that you don't get even the kind of the body of theology to refer to if you're asking those questions, and it's just, or it's considered a sort of niche area. So I think it's quite difficult for people. That's certainly the conversations I've had with people.
Yeah, and I think when we think about like the Black theologians, I think there are many more than we even know. It's just that they aren't always platformed in the way that others are. And so some of the work I've been doing is making sure we platform those people who don't have those platforms.
So tell me about how the Jude 3 project came about then, Lisa. You talked a bit about, you know, your own personal journey, but I guess there's a big leap between, you know, initially seeing that there's a gap and there's a need to actually establishing, you know, a big successful organization that you now run. So tell me a bit about how G3 Project came about and how you got it off the ground, and a bit about what you do now as in the role of kind of heading that up.
Yeah, and I'm shocked that I even do that. I spent most of my life wanting to be a stockbroker after my fifth grade teacher made us play the stock market game. And I was like, man, when I grow up, I'm going to be a stockbroker. I'm going to work on Wall Street. I'm not going to be in ministry at all. I'm going to go to a mega church and just sit in the back, because I have been involved in church life my whole life. So I was like, this is how my life is going to be. In college, I was dating the guy, and he told me that God had called him to be a pastor. And I broke up with him just because of that. That was how anti being in ministry I was.
But God had other ideas, presumably.
Yeah, he did. So taking that class really shifted me. So I switched from financial investment major to investment finance major, I'm sorry, to PR and religious studies. And I only chose PR because I had a lot of free courses in which I could take as many religious studies courses as I wanted, because our school didn't have a major, but they had a minor. But I took enough classes to have a major, because I had a lot of free electives in that major. And so, and my parents didn't want me to just get a religion degree. They wanted me to have something to fall back on. So I chose PR and religious studies, not thinking they would ever work together, but I use them every day now in tandem. And so then, strangely, went into banking after college, got a job working as a banker for Bank of America, then went into mutual funds for Merrill when they merged with Bank of America. Yeah. So I did that for 2 years. And then I was still teaching apologetics courses at my father's church. And one of the church mothers was like, when are you going to go get your master's? You're really good at this. And that was about the end of June of 2014. Was that 2014? No, 2012. That was the end of June 2012. And from that moment, I just felt the Holy Spirit tugging on my heart. And so the only school that had open enrollment was Liberty University, which I didn't know really much about Liberty. And that's a whole nother conversation in itself. But I was like, well, if I don't do it now, I'm not going to do it. So I quit my job on faith, packed up, and moved on a whim to Lynchburg, Virginia. Because I felt like that's what God wanted me to do. So not knowing anybody, that's what I did. And then the last year of seminary, 2014, I started the G3 Project, just a website, not knowing really what God was going to do with it, no formal business plan. And really just it grew over time and to what it is right now.
So tell me about some of the incredible stuff you've been doing with G3 Project. Tell me about some of the most exciting projects you've been involved in.
So two of the most exciting projects that we've done is our HBCU tour, Historically Black Colleges and Universities, in which we hold these forums to challenge students on this false narrative that Christianity is the white man's religion. And we started it because we were hearing from students that was big on their campus, and they didn't really know how to engage or defend their faith. And so I thought it would be a good idea to have those type of apologetic forums on Black college campuses that really are neglected in the apologetic space. And so that's what we did. And we've done multiple schools over the last several years. I'm excited to, that's why I'm so excited. I would be so excited when this Corona stuff is over, because I love engaging with students on college campuses. And I mean, they're like, well, we can do virtual, but it's just not the same interaction. And so in addition to that, we had Courageous Conversations, which is our annual conference in which we pair Black leading conservative scholars with Black leading progressive scholars on topics like faith, on topics like justice, sexuality, the authority of scripture, reaching Black millennials. There's a whole gamut. We've had 13 conversations in person, and we did several virtual ones before we even had the conference. And so those are two of my favorite projects. And also we are rolling out, we rolled out our curriculum. We have an online course, but we're trying to roll out an online academy. So that'll probably be my third favorite project once that's launched.
And so in terms of that question, Lisa, you know, is Christianity the white man's religion? How do you even go about answering that?
I always start when engaging a person one-on-one is, why do you feel that way? Because a person usually has experiences that feed that. And so I want to hear from them, like, what is their starting point with that? And even in forums, we try to do that. So in our on-campus forum, we start with a thing called talk back, where we let the students tell us why they think that before we even start the discussion. Because I feel like that's important to listen. I think the biggest thing we can do as apologists is be good listeners. And so listening well is important for that question. And then usually it's some personal trauma that goes along with that question that needs to be engaged first before you get to the information. Now, many people just like to throw information on people, but I don't think that's always the wisest thing, especially when they have trauma that is the root of that. And so if you engage the trauma first, you have a better chance to actually engage the idea and helping them help transform their thinking in relationship to that.
Just to sort of clarify, when you're talking about trauma, are you talking about things like racism?
So racial trauma, having microaggressions in church from white parishioners, or just understanding the history of racism in America and the church. And so people bring all that with their question. And so engaging that, I think, is first. And then once you engage that, then you move to information. I try to push people further back in history to look at early African history, knowing that the early church fathers were African, Athanasius, Tertullian. And so people that really shape our Christian doctrine were African people. And so helping people see that, I think, helps combat that narrative.
And are you seeing a lot of people respond and a lot of people coming to faith through your work?
Sometimes it's immediate. Many people come and they're about to walk away from Christianity. So the first one we did, one of the guys got up and during Q&A, he was like, I'm here because I'm on the verge of walking away from Christianity. And I felt like coming here may give me some reason to stay. That's really a big pool of people that we've been ministering to. It's kind of like that Jude, pulling some from the fire, that passage in Jude. And I feel like our ministry definitely pulls more young adults from the fire than anything. Young adults who grew up in church, and they're like on the verge of leaving, and they run across our ministry, and then they're like, okay, this is clarifying for me. This is helpful. And so yes, we do have some people come to faith, but also I think that would be 50%, but the other 50 would be those who were literally pulling from the fire.
That's really interesting. And what is it, what are the driving factors for those people? What's pushing them out of churches?
So I think their experience in church, if you grew up in church, you could see the hypocrisy and you could get tired of it. One of the things is, I think for millennials and Gen Z, is seeing their parents be so engaged in church, but it not change their personal attitude towards them or others. So they're like amazing in church, but horrible at home. And so it's kind of like, if you go to church all the time and you're doing all this and you're a public success, but as a parent, you're a private failure, I don't want that faith. So I think that's a big portion of it. them seeing, understanding the history of Christianity in America is also a factor. And I think also just trying to find peace. So there are really five P's, I call them pain points, that I think people are really looking for in this day as it relates to faith. They're looking for personhood, which falls under identity, protection, provision, power, and pleasure. That's six, but I think I added the pleasure recently. But personhood, protection, provision, power, peace are the essential ones. And then people are also looking for pleasure, but the main ones are the first five I mentioned. And I think when we get to the root of many people's questions across racial lines, that's at the root of most of it. And so I think we have to show how the gospel meets those needs in order for them to see relevance in this faith.
And going back to talking about racism again, because I think there are some people that actually say, come off it, there's racism doesn't exist in the church these days, we're in 2020, you know, all the rest of it, or who kind of refuse to see or believe that there are differences between people. Do you think there's racism in the church? And if so, how do you think we can combat that?
Yeah, so I definitely think there's racism in the church. I think there's structural and institutional racism. There's not just individual racism, but there's structural and institutional racism. And I think one of the ways we combat that is, well, three ways. We listen, we lament, and then we legislate. And when people think of legislation and policies, that's also, you know, government policies, but also we can think of legislation as how we work within these systems that have, in these denominations, that have their own kind of government and their own rules and laws and how they abide. And we could see how can we dismantle that. Like you think about the Southern Baptist Convention and how much of their funding came from slave owners, their initial funding. And so what can we do to act justly in those situations? How can we make things right? How can we put laws in place in our own organization to rectify that? So I think those are some things we need to do. But I think the listening part is really necessary, because I think, you know, many Christians aren't good listeners, and myself included. I have to work to listen. It takes work, especially when you're knowledgeable about a topic, because you want to show off the information you've learned. You want to make sure people understand that you're knowledgeable on a particular topic. So it takes work to just be silent and to listen without being defensive as well. So I think the church has to work on listening to those on the margins without being defensive, without, if I say there's systemic racism, to not necessarily mean I'm calling you yourself a racist. Like, you know, it's so much, the defensiveness, I think, keeps us from moving forward.
I was recently watching Michelle Obama's new Netflix documentary, Becoming. And in that, she said that of all the disappointments and the challenges of her time in the White House, the thing that had caused her the most trauma was the fact that voter numbers among the Black community had remained so low. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Why do you think there is disengagement from the Black community when it comes to politics?
Mm-hmm. I think because we haven't seen the needle move much in our communities. And so if there's no actual like effect from us doing the work in the systems, then it's like, well, what's the point? I think it's kind of like throw up your hands, kind of like it's not going to help anyway. And so I think if we saw some legislations that deeply impact the community, that make the community better, it motivates people. But people are tired of seeing Republicans get in, Democrats get in, and the condition is still the same. And so if the condition stays the same, then it doesn't motivate people to get out there. People want to see tangible results. And so I think that's one of the things.
So do people feel that even under Obama, that their situation didn't improve?
Yeah, I think some do. I think some do. I think others might feel differently. Mm-hmm. I think within, as far as the wealth gap is still there, where you know, it is what it is, that the Black community is still is disproportionately affected in that space. So there's still a huge gap in wealth in Black communities, more so. Phil Vischer, the creator of Veggie Tales, just released a very good explainer video on the wealth gap, which I think would help people and is really helpful. Like, Black wealth in America is usually generated by home ownership. And because there were laws in place and redlining and government legislation that kept Black people out of the home ownership game, that created a wealth gap. And so I think understanding that really will help people to understand why we still are in the condition we're in.
Well, that brings us to the end of part one. Hang around for more from Lisa on the challenges she's faced as a Black woman in the apologetic space.
Pop on the kettle, put your feet up, and enjoy the company of Premier Christianity magazine.
Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine, full of inspirational stories from a Christian perspective. Immerse yourself in current affairs, articles, trends, and interviews. And now benefit from our monthly subscription. Just £4.95 monthly for print and digital access. Search Premier Christianity online today.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to The Profile on Premier Christian Radio with me, Megan Cornwell. Today I'm speaking with Lisa Fields, the head of the apologetics organisation Jude 3 Project. In part two of our interview, she explains how the complementarian evangelical culture in America has stymied her progress in ministry, and she shares the best advice she's ever been given. Listen in. And it's been fascinating, hasn't it? Just sort of America in the last decade, we've just been talking a bit about some of those changes. But, you know, we saw the first ever Black president elected, and he came in with a message of hope and change. And then that's been followed by Trump, whose language many people have described as divisive. Lisa, can you shed any light on why you think Trump has got such a loyal supporter base among evangelical Christians?
That's an interesting question. I think one of the things is that many white evangelical voters are one and two issue voters. So they're focused on same-sex marriage and abortion. Well, no, three, and religious freedom. So those three guide everything that they do. And their motivation for getting Trump in the White House was him electing judges that benefited their agenda. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where their loyalty lies. And also, I think there is a fear that, you know, in a few years that they won't be the majority anymore. Minorities will surpass them in this country. And I think that there's a deep fear of being the minority. Be guilt around how they treated minorities and not wanting to feel like they're going to get the vengeance, or, you know, that could be that the deep commitment to the systems that they created, and so I think that's some of the reasons why their commitment is so strong, because it upholds their ideology and keeps them in power, and so I think it's really about power, and it's about their own prosperity,
which is quite antithetical to what Jesus taught, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. And I think even people who aren't that overt about it still have this deep longing to hold the power in this country. They might not say it like that, but you let them talk long enough and their ideals will start to show.
So to move now to talk a bit more about your work, Lisa, in apologetics and that sort of arena has traditionally been quite a male-dominated area, hasn't it?
Yes.
Can you share some of the challenges that has thrown up as a woman in that space?
Yeah. So I remember when I first started, maybe a year in, I was talking to a white evangelical leader that was in some ways trying to aid and help me. And he said to me, Lisa, you're going to have a very difficult time doing what you're called to do because you have some things working against you. And he was just being frank. He said, you're a woman, you're young, you're Black, and you're single. And he was keeping it real because he understood that organizations have a very difficult time giving to Black people, number one, but number two, women, and women that are not married, because the evangelical organizations can be very complementarian. I have a very complementarian ideology. And so if there's no male that they feel is covering you, they feel like you're out here just all alone. Like, yeah, who's the man that you're going to run your ideas through? And then they have a hard time interacting with women. So I found that many evangelical men struggle to even look me in the eye because I don't know, I guess just a single woman or just a woman period outside of their spouse makes you a temptress. And also it makes it difficult to have business meetings, right? Because the culture of evangelicalism is a Billy Graham rule kind of culture. So you can't meet with the opposite sex by yourself, which makes it hard when you're leading an organization.
Have you navigated some of those challenges?
You could have meetings virtually where you're not alone with them. That's, you know, conference calls. Some I'm just X'd out of the room altogether. You know, I'm not able to enter that space because of those restrictions. So that's one thing. I think in regards to fundraising, though, that is the biggest challenge, because people don't want to give to women-led orgs, and they struggle to give to Black people, period, because they won't say it out loud, but they don't trust Black people to manage their money. They'll never say it out loud, but it's a subconscious thing. That's that embedded racism that's in American society, and stats show how underfunded Black-led orgs are. And so it's really pushed me to think about being more so not relying on fundraising, to relying on products and services. Mm-hmm. So those are the ways I've navigated. Like, I really have to not only be a nonprofit leader, but I have to operate as a real businesswoman. I don't have the luxury of just relying on people to give me support and funds. And so I think that is helpful for me, because that way I'm not restricted in what I can say. I could really speak truth to power, because when people give you funding, they can also cut it as fast as they give it. And so that's why even many evangelical orgs can't even speak on justice right now, because their funding will be cut. And so because I'm moving towards a more products and services model, I don't have to worry about that being my reality.
Do you have anyone that you feel is championing you and what you're doing?
Yeah. So I think some orgs have been very supportive. I think one of the things I think is really providential is that Ravi was really big in me developing a passion for apologetics, and his organization has really helped me in support in that way, financially, and, you know, so they have been a big support. So I'm very encouraged by them, and it's only God's, I feel like providence that would happen, because I wouldn't even be an apologist without Ravi. And then the fact that later on God would send them in my life to help, I think is amazing.
What advice would you give to other Christian women, Lisa, who are wondering whether apologetics is for them?
I would say that we are really, I think, going to be the key to apologetics thriving in the next generation. Apologetics usually is debate-based. It's very heady. It's trying to fight reason. It's trying to fight these illogical ideas and philosophical ideas with reason. And most people in this generation, their response is really deeply rooted in emotion and trauma. And so reason often misses those who are forming their arguments with trauma. It's like talking to a wall. And I think women are really good at understanding people's emotions. And I think our ability to do that helps us penetrate in a way that men can't. Mm-hmm. And we do it naturally. And so I think we should really embrace that and rethink and reshape apologetics through that lens. And so I think the next group of dynamic apologists are going to be women. And in a space where we were locked out and maybe not thought of as the best person to do it, I think men are going to be looking at us, looking to us to lead in this moment. They're not going to penetrate with many people and just arguing. I mean, you can have arguments all day, but I'm more interested in winning the person than winning the argument. And sometimes that means you don't respond to everything you think is absurd. There's some conversations where you're like, well, I'll let you have that. We'll have another conversation about that a later time. That's not a hill I'm going to die on for this conversation because I'm trying to get to the root. And I think women have the patience to do that. And so I would encourage the women that are listening to lean into that, to study, to show yourself approved, know your stuff, but also mix that with the emotional engagement.
Are you sort of trying to raise up, I mean, along with all the other things that you're doing, are you, one of the things you're doing, raising up women to be apologists?
Yes. Our new curriculum through Eyes of Color, it is, I curated it, but it's written by Yana Connor, an up-and-coming Black scholar that she's a few years younger than me. But I'm excited that to be working with her. We have interns that are Black women. Our whole team, I think, is Black women. outside of maybe two men that help with other things. They help with graphics and video production. But everybody else on my team is a Black woman. And so I'm excited that I'm able to help them and give opportunities to them to lead in that way.
You said in the past, Lisa, that if it hadn't been for apologetics, you probably would have walked away from your faith. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
I needed something, some kind of intellectual rigor to engage what I was experiencing for my professor. PhDs, professors can be intimidating when you're a freshman, sophomore, junior, senior in college. Because you're like, man, they know it all. They spent the time in school. And so that intimidation in that moment makes you want to like give up. And it was like seeing other scholars that had the same education be able to interact with their ideas was what I needed to stay in.
Just talking more generally about your life and your faith, over the years, Lisa, what do you think is the most important thing that God has taught you?
I think to be more invested in being faithful than anything else. That faithfulness to Him and living a life that pleases Him in public and private is primary to my growth and development. To trust and rely on Him. I think in this space where it's like, man, I feel like, God, you put me in a space where I'm such a disadvantage. Like, why wouldn't you put me in an easier space? It's taught me to trust and rely on Him for provision, trust and rely on Him for connections, trust and rely on Him for just emotional support, because there's not many people who can identify with the space I'm in. Mm-hmm. And so that you feel lonely a lot of times, and I have to really trust in the Lord.
And I guess that brings me on to my next question, which is how do you make sure that you're growing in your relationship with God every day and that you are putting God at the center of your life? How do you do that?
I think one of the things that helps me grow is my circle that keeps me accountable. And I always tell people, always have a circle that doesn't care about any of the notoriety or any kind of even people that aren't even in the circle. So when I could get excited about one of the most exciting days of my life was when I met Ravi. I was excited about that, but there's so many of my friends that didn't know who he was. So it's like, oh, okay. Like, and just continue to go on to the next thing. if my circle was just full of people who were had the same interests and were like me, I think it could be very toxic to my growth, because it would always be feeding my ego and I would always feel like I'm bigger than I am. But I think one of the keys to my development is having people around me. I'm at the same church I've been at my whole life, my father's church. Everybody knows me since I was a kid. So nobody's like blowing smoke in my face. They're like, oh, we're excited. But it's like, okay, can you still go get the trash? You know, I think that's key to my development and growth, is to stay around people who aren't fascinated with who you are. And what God is doing in your life.
And what would you say was the best piece of advice you've received during your Christian walk, and who did it come from?
I say my mom. She reminded me that Christianity is not a sprint, it's a marathon, and that faithfulness has to be lifelong. She always tell me, like, yeah, you could be thriving right now, but if you live 70 years, like, I'm 33, that's substantial amount of time left. And so that faithfulness to God is a lifelong endeavor. And so that I have to realize that I could be running now, but I have to make sure I run to the end. And so I think that's the best piece of advice that I've received, because it helps me keep things in perspective and knowing, like, this is a window of time. We see throughout the kings of the Old Testament, some of them did well for most of it and then fell off. You know, look at Solomon. He did well and then fell off. And so I don't want to be the person that does well and has a whole bunch of accomplishments and then forsakes the Lord at the end or in the middle. I want to be consistent throughout the process.
And Lisa, if you could go back in time and give your younger self a little bit of advice, what would that be?
I think it would be to tell my younger self that everything will be okay. It will be okay. I think I thought some things were more pressing than they were, and that it would be okay. It's going to be okay.
What kind of things would those be then?
I think just start organizationally. Like, I didn't think that I would make it this far. And so I was like, oh, this isn't going to work. Many times I was like, oh, we're not going to get far. People are not going to accept our requests. Like, all of those things come to your mind. Oh, we're not going to get sponsors. I remember when we did the first Courageous Conversations and I had really almost $0. And I said, we're going to do it. And they told me, you're going to need about $50,000. And I was like, okay. And I signed all the contracts. I booked all the speakers, literally on faith. And that was the most, that was the scariest 5 months in my life, because I had to really trust in God. And I'm looking like, this isn't going to work. People are going to think my organization is a sham. People are going to get here and I'm not going to have their honorarium. I'm not going to have the hotel expense. I'm not going to have any of it. And, but the Lord provided. And I realized how much time I wasted that I could have enjoyed if I had have just trusted fully in God during that time. So I would definitely go back and tell myself it's going to be okay.
And looking forward now, Lisa, what are the kind of new and exciting plans for Jude Free Project? I mean, I'm sure the pandemic has probably affected a lot of what you were going to be doing this year, but what are the kind of things that God's been speaking to you about in lockdown, or what are the kind of the plans you have for the organization going forward?
Mm-hmm. Definitely want to expand with the online academy. We're doing some work right now, reshaping our curriculum to make it specifically for high schoolers and college students. So this is, through Eyes of Color, it's just for the everyday church core, but we want to change some things to make it relevant for youth and college students and the concerns they have for them. So that's one of the things we're going to be doing. We're going to be creating more video content that's engaging younger people around apologetics and how it's unique to Black spaces. So Those are some things I'm excited about and doing more. I really want to hit every HBCU in the nation. That's my goal. That's one of my goals. And so I'm really excited to try to create ways in which we can fund us reaching that goal. So
just for the English audience, is that the equivalent of the Christian Union in universities?
Yeah, creating forums in which we could also create other events to help train on those campuses, yeah.
And in terms of your time in lockdown, you said you've been very busy, so you may have found it difficult to find time to sort of spend with God. But do you feel like God is speaking to you about anything in particular at this time or directing you in any particular way at the moment?
I think one of the things God keeps kind of pushing on me is to trust in him, to trust him with all that I have. And even though, you know, you get through these, you get to these mountaintop moments, after every mountaintop moment, it seems like you go straight down to a valley, in which you have to trust him to get up the mountain again. And so really just trusting him, trusting his plan, and trusting that he will guide and order my steps. And mm-hmm. so that's one of the major things, which is an ongoing thing throughout my life.
Well, look, Lisa, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to tell us a bit about the work of G3 Project, and wish you all the best with that.
Thank you, Megan. It was a joy.
Well, that's all we've got time for today on The Profile. But join us again, same time, same place, next Saturday on Premier Christian Radio.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com apply.